Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Kaelin Davenport, a senior lecturer in Roman history at Macquarie University and a Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University, Frankfurt. This is episode CXLVI. The sun is getting real low. The Roman Empire was unprepared for the rule of the Emperor Maximinus. Regarded by many as a savage barbarian, he came to the purple by blood, would rule by blood, and would leave it much the same way. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
The period from the death of Severus Alexander in 235 to the accession of Diocletian in 284 is often referred to as the crisis of the third century. A lot of scholars are now debating the extent of the crisis and whether it penetrated all areas of the empire. But we can definitely say for our podcast on the emperors of Rome that there was definitely a political crisis during this period of almost 50 years. So we're looking at about 26 legitimate emperors with the rank of Augustus during this period. So they're the emperors recognized by the Senate at Rome, as well as by the army. During this period, we'll see a breakaway Roman Empire, the so-called Gallic Empire, which controls Gaul, Spain, and Britain for a period of about 14 years. So these are people who set themselves up as emperors in Gaul. They have their own Senate, their own consuls. They claim Roman authority. So there's about six of them during this period. Plus, there are countless other rivals and claimants to the imperial purple, mainly along the Rhine, Danubian, and Euphrates frontiers. So those zones of conflicts, we have provincial armies acclaiming their own emperor, who they think can help them deal with the current invasions.
Mm-hmm. And when you say that there's 26 recognized emperors by the state during that time, that averages out to about 2 years each. But there were periods during the crisis of the third century where Rome seems to hold its breath and kind of be stable with the one emperor for a large amount of time. And then there'll be a flurry of activity and a few that only last 2 months in its emperor, say, and
exactly. Yes. So you'll get someone like Philip the Arabian, who reigns from 244 to 249. And then in the next 4 years, you get a series of emperors, Trajan Decius, Trebonianus Gallus, Aemilius Aemilianus, and other usurpers. And then you have the dynasty of Valerian and Gallienus, which rules from 253 to 268. So these periods where a dynasty establishes itself, and yes, and then there's might be a flurry of 2 month or 6 month emperors or emperors in different regions of the Roman Empire. It's quite different from in the first century AD, you know, the year of the four emperors, when the goal for these emperors is to get to Rome and to claim authority in Rome itself. But in the third century, many emperors never visit Rome. And they're still recognized by the Senate. They still have coins minted, you know, laws, edicts issued in their name, but they never come to Rome itself as emperor.
There's terms like principate and
dominate.
And we're at the turning point of that now?
Yes. So usually in older scholarship, people talk about the principate lasting from Augustus to the Severan period, and then the dominate from Diocletian onwards to the fall of the Roman Empire.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a false dichotomy, because emperors are called dominus, master or lord, well before Diocletian. So it's a bit of an outdated dichotomy, but it does reflect the fact that in the third century, there is a change in the type of Roman emperor. You actually get emperors rising from the ranks of the soldiery to claim the purple. And there is an emphasis on the distancing between emperor and subject. So under Augustus, you have the idea of the coelus princeps, the emperor who acts as if he is a fellow citizen. And it's about equality and how he interacts with his peers. Whereas in the later Roman Empire, it's about the distancing, the differentiation between emperors and senators and other subjects. So there is a change. I mean, you can see these sort of changes in ceremonial beginning under Septimius Severus, but they're consolidated throughout the 3rd century. The Roman authors did think there was a change after the death of Severus Alexander. So Aurelius Victor, who wrote his book On the Caesars in the 4th century, in the 360s, writes in chapter 24 about the death of Alexander Severus as a turning point. He says, "Henceforth, as long as the emperors were more intent upon dominating their subjects than upon subjugating foreign peoples, and they preferred to fight amongst themselves, they threw the Roman state into a steep decline, as it were, and men were put in power indiscriminately, good and bad, noble and base-born, even many of barbarian extraction."
All right, well, that's a good segue as well. So let's talk about the poster boy for that quote.
Yes. This is Maximinus, Gaius Iulius Verus Maximinus, to give him his full name, very often called Maximinus Thrax or Maximinus the Thracian, though this appellation or nickname is first attested in the late 4th century AD. And it's actually a bit of a misnomer because he probably wasn't from the province of Thrace itself. The ancient writers would often use the term Thrace to refer to the entire Danubian or Balkan region. So Sir Ronald Syme, the great Roman historian, thinks he probably came from Moesia, which is near Thrace anyway.
Okay, within throwing distance?
Yeah, within throwing distance, yeah. It's very close. But I also think the name Thrax sort of conjures up this image of this barbarian, huge half-wit, which certainly the ancient authors like to conjure up themselves as well.
It's a very harsh-sounding kind of name, so...
Yes, exactly.
It kind of fits the personality well that ancient historians are trying to put forward, I think. So we encountered him in the previous episode of Emperors of Rome that we did, which was on the death of Severus Alexander.
Yes.
But we skipped over his background origin for a bit, essentially saving it for this episode.
Yes.
So what I gathered from the ancient sources is there's little that we know concrete about his background. Herodian says very little. The Augustan history says a lot, which is quite interesting but probably fanciful stuff.
Yeah, the emphasis is on the description of Maximinus as a great big hulking warrior. This is what they really go for here. So the Historia Augusta in 6.8 of its life of the two Maximini says, "He was of such a size, so Cordus reports, that men said he was 6 inches over 8 feet in height, and his thumb was so huge that he used his wife's bracelet for a ring." So, you know, he's about 2.6 meters high. You know, he'd make a good basketball player. And, you know, the idea is we have this timid child turned adult emperor under his mother's thumb, and he's being ousted by this big, brutal warrior. And, you know, the descriptions are great. No, I think there's no doubt that Maximinus was of a very different background to Severus Alexander. He's someone who was probably the descendant of a soldier. We know he had Roman citizenship from his names. You know, he's Gaius Iulius Verus Maximinus. One of his ancestors may have been given a citizenship by a governor of Moesia in the past. But the ancient sources, again, play up him as a barbarian, who's someone who's very different from a true Roman. So the Historia Augusta says he was born to a Gothic father and an Alanic mother. So the Goths and the Alans, so two different tribes. Herodian also says that he was half barbarian, and says in 6.8.1, "As a boy, he was a shepherd, but that in his youthful prime, he was drafted into the cavalry because of his size and strength." It's really interesting, the fact that he's said to be a shepherd. With many of these emperors of the 3rd century, we have these rags-to-riches stories of there being shepherds or farmers or other sort of sons of shopkeepers or something like that, that find sort of fame and fortune in the military. So it's very much a topos, a cliche of this period.
I think it's the Augustan history says that he's a blacksmith, the son of a blacksmith as well. So still going with that rags to riches kind of thing. Besides the differences between the two, a lot of the themes are he's come from a humble origin.
Yes.
And his hulking size, which no matter how big, and even if it's, you know, like Constantine levels tall and everything, it's that much of a difference to Alexander.
Definitely.
And maybe that's just what makes it more pronounced at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a contrast between the two men, and that's really played up in our sources. Mm. What we can say is that he's a Roman citizen, and he's definitely of equestrian rank at the time that he seizes the throne. So he is an officer. He's in charge of recruits in the German army of Severus Alexander. He's probably in his early 60s as well. So I would say he's someone who comes from a military family, and the family has acquired wealth through their military service, or perhaps he's one of these new breed of officers who actually gain equestrian rank through their military service.
And while we don't know a lot of specific details about his background, I do want to kind of bring up what it says in the Historia Augusta, no matter how fanciful it is,
of course,
about his origins in the military career and his interactions with Septimius Severus for a couple of reasons. One is that it makes me remember the good old days back with Septimius Severus.
Yes.
I never thought I'd say that in this podcast, but I yearn for the days of, you know, of Septimius Severus. And two, Herodian just kind of glosses over all this kind of detail and doesn't offer any of it. So we'll go with what we've given, even though the disclaimer is it's probably BS.
Of course, yes. I mean, what the Historia Augusta is trying to do is it's interested in the personalities of the emperors. So when it doesn't have information, it concocts these sort of plausible backstories in order to fill in the details. Because when we're reading a biography, we want to know about how people came to be in a position of power. So we have these stories about how Maximinus sort of interacts with all the previous emperors of the Severan dynasty. He fights in games on Geta's birthday in front of Septimius Severus and impresses the emperor by winning 16 challenges, even though, as the Historia Augusta says, you know, he's a youth, he's half barbarian and scarcely yet master of the Latin tongue. So because, you know, he's spotted by Septimius Severus, he rises up through the ranks, you know, he's patronized by Severus and Caracalla. He also encounters Elagabalus as well, but unlike the effeminate Elagabalus, you know, he's a real man. So he says, you know, he had no influence with that filthy man, with Elagabalus. So they're really marking him out as a different sort of breed from these Severan child emperors.
Mm. And if he is 60, which we've got no reason to doubt that, I suppose, when he becomes emperor in his 60s, he's going to have a military career which goes back to the time of Septimius Severus. So he would have perhaps interacted with these emperors at different points in his life.
Oh, definitely. You know, he would have a long military career behind him. And certainly if he's someone who's worked his way up the ranks to become a centurion, then a chief centurion, and acquired equestrian rank after that, that requires, you know, 30, 40 years of service to get to that position. And many men didn't survive that long because of all the wars that were happening.
And also, sorry, I'm just thinking more here, that if you've got a half-barbarian of that size, you park him right behind the emperor in the crowd shots just to intimidate all the barbarians that you're charging against.
So we know from Herodian that Maximinus definitely served under Severus Alexander in his Persian campaigns. And it was after this that he was made Praefectus Tyrannibus, or prefect of recruits in the German campaign.
Mm.
And Zosimus, another Greek source for the 3rd century AD, who I mentioned in our podcast under Alexander Severus, also gives us some key details. So Zosimus is writing the 6th century, but he used earlier Greek sources from the 3rd century. And he says that Maximinus was the commander of a cavalry unit. So again, these are familiar posts from the equestrian officer career.
So let's move to what we can say about Maximinus's perspective about becoming the emperor. So again, depending on what source you look at, this is either something that he wanted and welcomed or was thrust upon him.
the army comes to him, basically. They're unhappy with Severus Alexander, the timid little boy attached to his mother's apron strings, and they want a proper ruler, proper military man on the throne leading their campaigns. The ancient sources portray him as the first of the so-called soldier emperors. And we find this in the sources from the 4th century AD. So Eutropius, who wrote a breviarium, a short history of Rome, says he was the first to come to power solely as the choice of the soldiers, since the authority of the Senate had played no role and he himself was not a senator. The historian Augusta in Life of the Two Maximini 8.1 says Maximinus was the first man from the body of the soldiers and not yet a senator to be acclaimed Augustus by the army without a decree of the Senate. Aurelius Victor says he was practically illiterate, the first common soldier to seize power as the choice of the legions. So there's very much this narrative developing that he is a soldier, not a senator. We need to nuance these claims. He was an equestrian like Macrinus, so you know, he's not a common legionary at the time, but the ancient authors definitely perceive this as a major turning point.
They emphasize, the ones that I've read, It seems like every sentence they end with, but he was a barbarian.
Yes.
But he couldn't speak Latin.
Yes.
But he was profusely sweating.
Yes, yeah.
The Augustan history's got a thing about Maximinus sweating.
Yes, yeah.
But like every sentence ends with a kind of, you know, mighty warrior, one of the soldiers, sweaty.
Yes. It sort of, you know, conjures up the image of, you know, this big man, you know, he's not an effete, perfumed emperor, you know, he's mucking in with the soldiers. They really want to emphasize this difference. And they want to show, you know, he's not one of us. You know, people like Aurelius Victor writing the 4th century, also senators as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's very much disbelief, though. You know, it's like, you know, can you believe this guy's the emperor?
Yes.
So, yeah, it's just like they continually come back to this. So proclaimed emperor, this is February 235 CE.
Yes. So the soldiers come to him and they basically declare him emperor. And this is one of the problems in the 3rd century AD. If an army tries to make you emperor, if you refuse, you're likely to be killed on the spot.
Sure.
If you become emperor, you know, there's a good chance you might be killed anyway. At least you've got some time and there's a chance you might be the exception. It also, you know, fits into the idea that an emperor should refuse the office at least once before saying, well, okay, you can make me emperor.
Mm.
But, you know, in the 3rd century, there's a real urgency about it. You know, the soldiers threaten to kill Maximinus, you know, who's one of their own, unless he says yes. So he's really left with no choice but to become emperor. So Herodian says, and this is 6.8, at first he refused the honour and threw off the purple, but when they pressed him and waving their swords threatened to kill him, he preferred the future risk to the present danger and accepted the empire. Often before, he said, dreams and prophecies had predicted this good fortune. He told the soldiers, however, that he accepted the honour unwillingly. He did not really want it and was simply obeying their wishes in the matter. I think Herodian's actually quite a good diagnostician of the problems of the 3rd century because when we talk about the endemic usurpations, it's not always the emperor themselves that motivates this. It's often the provincial armies or communities that want their own emperor, and they're really faced with no choice.
Yes. We'll be coming back to that in the very next episode,
yes,
actually.
We will.
But there's a slight spoiler there. Can't help but notice the parallel. But in this case, I kind of see Maximinus as being somebody who relished being the emperor.
Yes. So once he takes the role, he really embraces the idea that he is a soldier and his job is to defend the borders of the empire.
Yeah, pretty much what you read out there was the extent of the hesitation that he has in his entire span as emperor, I see. Yeah,
after that, he really just goes for it.
Yeah,
He is going to be a military man. And, you know, that's his qualification for the throne. So why not own it, I think?
Mm.
That's really important.
So instantly, he promises to double the pay to the army.
Yes.
So that's going to go down well.
Yes, we'll talk more about that later. But you might remember there'd also been pay rises under Septimius Severus and Caracalla. So.
And they had trouble paying for it as well. So
Exactly. So he says, no, I'll double the army pay. They march to Alexander's camp, and he sends a tribune and centurions to murder Severus Alexander and his mother, Mamaea, in their tent.
Mm.
And so Herodian sees this as a turning point in the type of government. This is what Herodian is really interested in. He's interested in the movement from aristocracy to tyranny. And so this is part of his idea about the turnover of emperors in the 3rd century. It's a bit like Polybius and Greek political thought. We have aristocracy or monarchy or tyranny, and Maximinus is the example of the tyrant. I'll just read out a passage from the beginning of Book 7 of Herodian, which I think neatly encapsulates this. Once Maximinus had taken over the empire, he caused a great change, exercising his power cruelly and causing widespread fear. He tried to make a complete transformation from a mild, tolerant autocracy to a savage tyranny. Conscious of the hatred against him for being the first man to rise from the most humble origins to such a fortunate position. So Herodian's actually saying, because he knows where he comes from, that he's aware that people are going to be out for him, they're going to criticise him. So he's just going to embrace that and become an all-out tyrant.
Can I just sidebar and say I like that translation better than what I've got?
That's why I read this one out, because...
I've got the lobe.
I just thought it really captured the change from the autocracy to the savage tyranny.
Well, they're still both using the word savage.
Yeah,
At different places. Yeah. But that's like a favourite word to describe Maximinus, so that one keeps coming up, savage.
Very much so.
Yeah.
The narrative in the ancient sources is that Maximinus is cruel and savage towards Alexander's associates, towards the Senate, towards the people, that he's seeking money to fund his campaigns. You know, he's bloodthirsty. He gets rid of some of Alexander's senatorial associates who are on campaign with him. Some are sent back to Rome, while others remain in Germany. According to Herodian, he didn't want anyone superior to be around him.
Mm.
So, you know, he doesn't want to be outshone by senatorial advisors. So we have this image not only of the tyrant, but the lonely tyrant. And you get that with Domitian as well. You know, Domitian who walks the colonnades of his palace alone, you know, in fear of what might be behind him. You know, the idea of a tyrant who shuts himself off from any good advice. So Maximinus doesn't go to Rome. He reigns for 3 years and never goes to the centre of the empire.
It might be the Augustan histories that say that he hated Rome. He just despised the place.
There's this sort of topos throughout the 3rd century that soldier emperors don't like Rome. The city doesn't suit them. You know, they have to interact with the Senate, the aristocracy. We can suggest, perhaps, if we try and reevaluate Maximinus, that there are pressing threats on the frontiers. And he does spend his entire reign campaigning, either in Germany or in Pannonia and Moesia. So he's actually doing what an emperor needs to do in the 3rd century, is to defend the frontiers. So there's stories about him sending back huge paintings of himself to Rome, engaging in heroic acts in order to show, you know, I'm ruling for you. I'm helping defend this great empire.
Hang this in the Senate House?
Hang this in the Senate House, yeah. It's what Elagabalus did as well. And
that's
there's
right,
actually
he
this
did, yeah.
long tradition of Romans exhibiting paintings of their exploits. So he fits into that tradition very nicely.
Mm.
Now, the Senate does recognise him as Augustus. So we know that on the 25th of March, 235, he is co-opted into the priestly colleges. He gets all the titles of Augustus, proconsul, pater patriae, pontifex maximus.
Yeah.
And he has a son as well, a teenager called Maximus. And when he is made Caesar, that's also ratified by the Senate as well. So there's no senatorial opposition in Rome itself against the rule of Maximinus.
There'd just be resignation. They wouldn't be happy with the situation.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it'd be resignation. I mean, what can they do at that stage?
Yes.
In Rome, when they're so far from the frontiers. I think, you know, they'd adopt a wait-and-see policy. Let's see what happens.
Sure. And grumble about it when the painting arrives.
Yes.
So while the Senate gives their assumably grumbling ascension to the current situation, there are challenges to Maximinus's authority, and these seem to be a lot closer to him.
Yes. So in Germany itself, there are two conspiracies against Maximinus by former associates of Severus Alexander. And so this gives us a picture of the people that had been travelling with Alexander and Mamia, serving in what is called the comitatus, the imperial retinue. And these would have had the official title of comites, or imperial companions. So Maximinus decides to continue the war, which Severus Alexander has started, and he builds a bridge over the Rhine to attack the Germans, and this is near Mogontiacum, this is modern-day Mainz. But one of Severus Alexander's old associates, who is a former consul called Magnus, is said to have engaged soldiers to destroy the bridge after Maximinus had crossed it, so that he would cut him off, and he hoped to betray Maximinus to the barbarians on the other side.
So do we know much about Magnus other than this one very brief appearance?
Well, it's been suggested that he is the same as a Gaius Petronius Magnus, who is attested on a bronze inscription from Italy, which we call the Album of Canusium. So it's from Canusium, and it's a list of all the patrons of that town, which includes senators and equestrians, praetorian prefects, so very high-ranking patrons. And the name of Gaius Petronius Magnus on this inscription has suffered damnatio memoriae. It's been scratched out. And there's obviously some reason behind that.
Burning down a bridge would,
would be
a reason.
And being discovered, so the plot fails and there's no investigation, but all the conspirators, including Magnus, are executed. Mm. And that would be a definite reason for then going back to the album and etching out his name. So it's a good chance that it is the one and the same person.
The other conspiracy at the time against Maximinus seems to have a bit more weight and threat to it, really.
Yes, this actually comes from a group of soldiers themselves, which is interesting because it shows that Maximinus doesn't have unanimous support. These are the archers from Osrhoene near Mesopotamia, and they're commanded by an officer called Macedo. And they decide to acclaim another ex-consul called Quartinus, who had been a supporter of Severus Alexander and had accompanied on his campaign. Maximinus had dismissed Quartinus, but the archers acclaim him emperor against his will, and Herodian says they brought the imperial throne a most reluctant occupant. Quartinus is quite literally undermined by the people who acclaimed an emperor, because Macedo, the officer, changes his mind, cuts off Quartinus's head and presents it to Maximinus, hoping to be rewarded by the new emperor. And instead, he is executed, which I think he deserves, really, for making this poor ex-consul emperor and then betraying him.
Yeah, I don't think it was, if I remember what I was reading, it wasn't so much the fact that Maximinus saw this man as a threat. It was the fact that he saw him as a betrayer of the person that he'd just made emperor.
Exactly.
So it was on principle more than anything.
Yes, if you've betrayed, you know, Quartinus, or, you know, what's he going to do to Maximinus? I mean, and once again, Herodian has a wonderful description of Quartinus being made emperor. He says, and this is Book 7, 1.9, Quartinus is fitted out with the fatal trappings of power,
nice,
the purple and the procession of fire. I just love that, the fatal trappings of power. The idea, you know, you're being made emperor, but it just exposes you to revolt, rebellion, usurpation, and you're bound to die.
Mm. That's your lerb again, isn't it?
It is my lerb, yeah. Yes. I think it's a fantastic description of the problems of the third century. And so this is why I think, you know, Herodian really gets what's going on in this period, which makes him a fantastic writer.
Mm. So now we get the first war that Maximinus officially engages with, and he spends the remainder of his reign rushing from one war/battle/skirmish/insurrection to another.
Yes, it's a very active 3 years.
He keeps the army busy.
He does.
He makes them earn their wage increase.
yes, you know, given what it's doing to the imperial economy, they definitely need to earn that double pay. And Herodian telescopes a lot of this detail, but we can see that Maximinus is really doing what he was supposed to do. So we're about in mid to late 235, so the northern hemisphere summer. So it's the German campaign, first of all. And we have some wonderful descriptions from Herodian about their battles against the Germans. He says in 7.2.6, that Maximinus plunged into the marsh, that the water was deeper than his horse's belly. There he cut down the barbarians who opposed him.
Mm.
And I think we can take this literally. This is Maximinus being an emperor who led from the front. This is what he'd been trained to do throughout his career. You know, Herodian talks about the Germans being annihilated, the swamp pool was choked with bodies, and the marsh ran red with blood. The land battle had all the appearance of a naval encounter, which I think is a wonderful description of what Maximinus and his army are doing there.
These battles that are being described in Herodian, it's these battles that are painted and sent back to the Senate.
Yes, that's right. Yes. And so Herodian describes sort of four key scenes of Maximinus crossing the bridge, burning villages, the barbarians hiding, and then the battle in the marsh. And so C.R. Whitaker, who is translated and commented on Herodian, has, you know, posed the question of how much of Herodian's description derived from seeing these pictures. So he says that it's probably not the fact that Herodian actually had an eyewitness to the battle itself, but he may have been relying on some other images or descriptions of battles that he had access to.
Mm.
So we know that Herodian had some sort of imperial service, so we don't know whether he was in Rome. It's a bit of a mystery, but, you know, it's the formulaic nature of the scenes that suggests they're described in a way that could be paintings.
Ah, because they don't just let everybody into the Senate House, do they?
No, but, if you're...
He could have been sweeping the floors.
Well, no, he might have been a freedman, it's been suggested.
Yeah.
He could have been a low-ranking equestrian. There's various possibilities.
He could have been out the back when they went out there to burn them.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's likely that when the pictures are brought into Rome, there might have been some sort of triumphal procession as well.
Yeah.
Because very often in triumphs...
Oh, like a public showing or something like that.
They displayed placards and scenes of battles in the triumphs. So that's a very old Roman tradition there.
Mm.
Especially if, you know, people in Rome had never seen the emperor. I mean, all this is quite speculative, but it's very interesting to think of the formulaic nature of these key scenes and the fact that Maximinus also sent similar paintings back to Rome.
So how extensive and how successful was this German campaign?
It seems to have taken several months, perhaps as many as 8 or 9 months. Herodian's account is very telescoped, but we know that the campaign would have begun in the summer of 235 and extended to early 236. So Maximinus begins around Mogontiacum, modern-day Mainz, and then in the northern hemisphere winter of 235 to 236, he would have spent the non-campaigning season at Castra Regina or Regensburg further east, and then sort of concluded the German campaign in early 236.
And how did he celebrate this? Because he doesn't go back to Rome for a triumph.
No, he doesn't go back to Rome. He takes the title Germanicus Maximus, greatest conqueror of the Germans.
And yes.
He makes his son, Gaius Julius Verus Maximus, Caesar. And it seems at this point that his wife, who has the name of Caecilia Paulina, is deified.
And she of the slender wrists.
Yes, she of the very slender wrists. See, exactly. We know very little about her. The only coins for her are these consecratio or deification issues. Some scholars have suggested that she may have died even before Maximinus came to the purple.
Mm.
But Ammianus talks about how she soothed Maximinus's cruel temper.
This is like stroking the lion.
Yes, kind of thing.
The savage beast.
Exactly. There are these stories, there are these wild emperors who have these mild wives who keep them under check. And if Ammianus is right, it suggests that she may have still been alive when he came to the throne.
It's just like Black Widow and the Hulk. The sun is going down, Maximinus. The sun is going down.
It's all okay. And it's thought that, you know, after she died, you know, his true cruelty could be unleashed then as well.
Yeah, again, like a Black Widow and the Hulk.
So, yes, he takes a title. His son becomes Caesar. His wife deified.
And the campaign moves on.
It does. He doesn't go back to Rome. His raison d'etre as emperor is to defend the frontiers. So he moves even further east now to Sirmium for a Danubian campaign. And we know this is successful because he earns further titles of Dacicus Maximus and Sarmaticus Maximus by the end of 236. So this is greatest conqueror of the Dacians and greatest conqueror of the Sarmatians.
Mm.
And we know, although Herodian's narrative is extremely telescoped because he wants to get to the exciting bits at the end of the reign, and it's clear he doesn't have good sources for the military campaigns, we know that his base is at Sirmium until early 238.
Okay.
And this is a city which had been used by previous emperors, such as Marcus Aurelius, as a staging post. So it's used to hosting emperors. But the fact that he never went back to Rome is probably taken as an insult.
We've talked about Maximinus essentially as a soldier.
Yes.
And that's the way that he's leading it. But he's got entirely another side of the empire that he needs to worry about, as in the fact that he's meant to be running the thing.
Mm.
Doesn't seem to really care about it as long as he keeps the money flowing.
Mm.
So how is he as an emperor? What do we know about that side of his reign?
Yes, well, obviously assessing Maximinus as an emperor is very difficult because the accounts are so negative. Obviously the fact that he was an active emperor defending the frontiers, but he also had to pay the army, which is going to put strain on the imperial budget. So we know that he promised to double army pay when he came to the purple. And this is the latest in a series of pay rises under the Severan emperors.
You've got them all here.
Yes. So to put this in perspective,
yeah,
in the reign of Marcus Aurelius, a soldier, an ordinary legionary, would be paid 1,200 sesterces per year. And this is the amount which had been fixed since the reign of Domitian.
Mm, so it hadn't moved much at all for a long time there.
No, yeah. Yes. So when Septimius Severus does increase army pay, they were due for a pay rise.
Mm.
So under Septimius Severus, a legion would be paid 2,400 sesterces per year. And I think that was a merited pay rise, you know, since the reign of Domitian.
Mm.
But Caracalla increases the army pay again by 50%, up to 3,600 sesterces per year. And because Maximinus then doubles that, an ordinary legionary would be paid 7,200 sesterces a year. This meant that the army budget had increased six times over the Severan period up to Maximinus's reign. So we're looking at a period of Septimius Severus probably introduced his army pay in about 197, so probably about 40 years of pay rises. But this is such a massive increase after the previous century of stability.
Mm. And Caracalla was struggling to pay that as well. I remember that being a big problem, and that's why he extended citizenship to so many people.
Exactly.
And now it's doubled.
He extends citizenship to increase the tax revenue. He also creates this new coin called the Antoninianus, which is a double denarius, but only has 1.5 times as much silver. So that's what Caracalla did. And now Maximinus has essentially doubled the outlay on the army.
So how's he going to pay for it then?
Well, Herodian paints a picture of a reign of terror with harassment of the rich, the senators in Rome, informers denouncing other senators on charges of treason, so they would be executed and their property confiscated. So Herodian says in 7.3.3, it was thus possible every day to see men who yesterday had been rich, today reduced to paupers. So great was the avarice of the tyrant. In addition to these confiscations, he is also supposed to have seized wealth in the temples in Rome, melting down statues of the gods, you know, seizing decorations and adornments from buildings, anything that could be used to mint coinage. And this provoked severe resentment against Maximinus by the people in Rome and the provinces.
Mm. That might be why Herodian is so emotive with his language about Maximinus, calling him a barbarian, calling him savage throughout the entire thing. Because essentially, the emperor is doing what the barbarians would be doing to Rome. He's sacking the temples. He's stealing the wealth.
Exactly. It is, you know, I think that's a good comparison. It is like a barbarian raid. I think we need to put it in context. So emperors had always benefited from the proceeds of confiscations or from people leaving their money in their wills.
Yeah.
So if we look at the imperial budget and the funds flowing into the imperial treasury, there are departments headed by officials to oversee the bona damnatorum, the goods of the condemned. So this had always been a source of wealth for emperors. But I think from Herodian's emotive language that Maximinus has taken it to another level. And it would certainly be amplified by the fact that he never actually came to Rome.
Mm.
So he's not seen, no one's interacting with him. But this wouldn't have just happened in Rome. It would also happen on a provincial level. There were clear orders to the procurators throughout the provinces to make sure they could squeeze every last penny out of the people.
So you'd get a lot of discontent brewing around the empire. You'd get a lot of resentment to the emperor.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't just want to paint this as a problem in Rome itself. We know there are procurators exacting taxes harshly or levying new taxes throughout the provinces. Indeed, it is one such attempt to collect money by a procurator in Africa that would prompt a revolt there in 238. And it was this revolt that would actually lay the seeds for Maximinus's destruction.
That's Dr. Kaelin Davenport, Senior Lecturer in Roman History at Macquarie University and a Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are always very helpful and appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport. I'm at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, we'll wade into yet another civil war, but until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.